You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network. Attention all theater lovers! This Sunday, April 21st, Broadway Podcast Network is holding the first ever Broadway Podfest, a full day of podcast recordings with some of your favorite Broadway stars, live from the Museum of Broadway, which is right in the heart of Times Square. The day begins at 11 a.m. Eastern and features a full day of programming that you don't want to miss. Visit bpn.fm/podfest to get all the details and register to attend for free. That's bpn.fm/podfest.
What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Hi, and welcome to The Compass, the podcast documenting the struggles of life as an artist. I'm Leah Walsh. My guest today is Dawn Michelle Johnson. Dawn is a beautiful violist and teacher. We were at Juilliard at the same time, and I've always admired her infectious energy and talent. We haven't seen each other since graduating, but have kept up over Facebook, as you do nowadays when you feel like you know what your friends are up to from afar. It was wonderful to hear about what she's been doing, and her outlook on life and teaching is very inspiring to me. I'm really excited to share this conversation. This was recorded over Skype, as she now lives in Washington, D.C. with her husband and little daughter. Just a side note before the interview, the show I've been lucky enough to be in since November, Drunkelvania, is finally closing April 15th. We can't extend again. So if you'd like to come out and see it, get your tickets now. We'd love to have you. Just go to drunkelvania.com for more information. I hope you enjoy the 67th episode of The Compass. Is what do you do to try to keep from going to the dark side as an artist?
The dark side.
Yes. And what is the dark side for you often?
Yeah, I mean, I guess first and foremost, my faith is probably the biggest anchor and pillar in my artistic development and just who I am as an artist. I come from this sort of perspective of, you know, God blessed me with the gifts that I have and my artistry. And so in order to keep from going to that dark place or the place that I say where I almost forget, you know, where I came from and who gave me these gifts, just every day, I actually have a prayer routine, you know, from the time I wake up in the morning to, you know, sometimes even when my family is still sleeping, I pray over them. And I, you know, when I have my morning routine, which is also very meditative for me, you know, that's the time where, you know, I'm playing my gospel music and I'm singing my songs in the shower and I'm praying in the shower. I feel very close for some reason to God when I'm around or near water. I feel like the ocean or the shower.
It's that Miami girl.
Yeah, exactly. That's the Miami in me. And so I do, you know, as many times throughout the day as I can sort of remember, you know, where I came from, who I came from, who blessed me with life, who blessed me with these gifts, who blessed me with a family, especially, you know, you look around and, you know, although we're all, from my perspective, you know, God's children, sometime with the craziness that we experience in our day-to-day lives, it's really easy to forget or sort of, you know, stop believing in, you know, who blessed us with life. And so I try to make that my silver lining in every day. Of course, some days are harder than others, especially, you know, when things, tragic things happen or, you know, life isn't always so great. So just trying to remember, like God is the center of my focus, my faith, my art, my talent, my gift amidst the good times and the bad times. And so it's sort of that anchor, you know, even though, you know, life has all of this ebb and flow and ups and downs, that's the one sustaining thing that you can always rely on, is that God is always right there, whether you believe it or not, see it or not, but there's always something bigger guiding you through life, and everything happens for a reason. So that's probably my biggest piece of faith from keeping myself from going to the dark side. And it's not to say that, you know, there aren't days that are somewhat depressing or sad or, you know, life can throw a curveball at you. But I think holding on to that faith gives you that piece of optimism that you need to always keep pushing, always keep going amidst the good, the bad, and the ugly.
Has that always been a part of your life, or is it something that you found later on?
Great question. That's actually something that really hit home for me, actually, after I had my daughter. So I had Briley. Briley's three now. She'll be four in September. And I always say to my husband, after, you know, I had her and, you know, went through labor and delivery, I just laid in the bed and just said, oh, my God, for like 10 minutes or what felt like an eternity. Because, I don't know, something just happened to me in that moment. I always tell my husband, oh, I think I briefly met God for a second. That's the only way I made it through that. But yes, you just, I mean, when you live for something and some people greater than yourself, I think it opens up your eyes to that there's someone greater than you, right, who's also sort of having that presence in your life. And so it took me, you know, getting married, like marrying my husband and having my daughter and starting a family of my own to realize, you know, I'm not doing this by myself, because these are things that I wasn't the girl growing up was like, oh my God, I can't wait to get married, or oh my God, I really want to be a mom, or like have a baby. You know, these were the things that just happened in my life. And once I was in a, you know, really great relationship with my now husband, and, you know, we have our beautiful daughter and just a great like family and great relationship. You just have to be thankful for these blessings. And they're truly, truly blessings, because, you know, having a little one definitely opens up your eyes to things that 31 years in life, you're like, oh, wait, no, nope, she's her own person. That's not me. You know, just finding different ways to sort of deal with someone who literally came out of you but is their own person.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I always refer back to the Bible, which is my compass for life. Mm-hmm. And just, you know, keeping things in perspective of there's something greater than me, there's something greater than all of us, making all of these parts move. But it took me actually physically having a child to giving life to another human being that really put those things into perspective for me. So I'm very thankful for it. I'm very, you know, blessed by it and because of it. And I think it's something I was actually, I think about it a lot now because, you know, what we do as artists, you don't see very many, at least the field that I'm in, classical music, orchestral music, chamber music, you don't see a lot of women become mothers for whatever reason, you know, let people do the things that they want to do with their lives. So whatever right. that reason is, but I think the stats will show that you don't see a lot of women, particularly in classical music, who have children. And I think a part of that, and I'm, you know, I fell victim of it, well, not victim, but I experienced this to a certain degree, was you spend so much time developing your craft and your gift and, you know, trying to win this job and practicing and, you know, doing this competition and going on tours and chamber music and playing here and there, that sometimes you think that that's all that life has for you. And so you almost cut yourself off from a whole nother world of existence that I didn't even know really existed until I finished school and, you know, got out here on my own. I met a wonderful man. I didn't realize that, like, there was so much more to life.
Well, it takes so much dedication.
Daily,
especially for you as a musician, like daily dedication to your practicing and everything. Of course you get tunnel vision because you feel like that's how you're going to succeed.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, absolutely. But look, there's a whole, I mean, we can open up the palette of things that we can do and that we're capable of and, you know, little blessings that can come into our life along the way that, you know, we should pay attention to because, you know, being a mom and being a wife now has actually really made me love my art even more because I have something bigger than myself and, you know, my audience to connect it to and to relate it to and to do it for. So just this notion of stepping outside of yourself for something bigger, for something greater, that's literally out there waiting for everybody.
That's so wonderful to hear. That's beautiful. Because that is something, like, as artists, since we are such a big part of what we're doing, like yourself, your being is part of your artistry. And when you make it your career, it's part of what you're using to make a living.
Absolutely.
And so I think for so many people, the dark side comes when we focus too much on ourselves and lose sight of that bigger picture. So that's amazing that having your family and having this relationship to God really allows you to keep that perspective.
Absolutely, because we become so self-critical in our process, even though, you know, that's partially necessary. You know, we have to look in to see the things that we're doing to be able to fulfill the things that need to come out. But, you know, it's constant self-analysis and critiquing. And when you're not critiquing yourself, you have a private teacher to critique you. And when they're not critiquing you, you have a member of your chamber group. So it's this constant me, which is necessary as a part of the process, but it's not the only part of the process. And so I think the more we start to engage ourselves in things outside of the me to help influence, you know, when we have that sort of introspection to ourselves, just the more well-rounded, the more, you know, whole we can be as artists. And it just helps that, you know, we do this for people, to connect other people. But if we're constantly just so wrapped up in ourselves, it's really hard to make that connection to whatever character you might be playing, or to whatever piece you might be learning, or to whatever audience you're trying to reach. So I think it's really important for us to just, you know, absorb all of these really wonderful things that all of life has to offer to influence us as artists, but to also, you know, help inform that self-analysis that's so critical to the process. But it's just a part of the process. It's not the entire process.
Yeah.
And so that's something really comforting, is that there's always something new to learn, always another person to reach, always, you know, there's always this room for growth, and to, you know, sort of spread your wings out to reach more and more and more, even though, right, the sort of contradiction to the process is we have to keep going in to find that. But I think there are different ways that we can play around with as artists to sort of really grow ourselves in that way.
So I see behind you on the wall that you're like in your classroom right now. Which is amazing.
I have a whole gallery that goes around. I don't know if you can see my classroom. So actually the thing behind me says, I don't know if you can see it. It says, "These are the people who believed in Mrs. Johnson, her teachers. Now as your teacher, Mrs. Johnson believes in you." So it's all of my teachers I've ever had, to just sort of, you know, give my students this feeling of optimism and hope, and that, you know, there are people who believe in you, who want to see you do well, who want to see you succeed, even though, you know, from day to day I'm in here beating you upside the head, F sharp, G, low risk, all those sorts of things. But to just sort of, again, have this broader picture of like why you're here, why we're doing this. So yeah I am in my classroom.
So are you teaching full time now, or just
Yes. I've been with KIPP DC, it's like the largest network of public charter schools in DC, for going on almost 8 years now.
Wow.
And so I've had various roles throughout the organization. Last year I was their director of music and arts for all of their schools here in DC.
Wow.
And I was also teaching full time, so that became a little much.
Yeah.
So I actually stepped down from my position as director of music and arts, even though I still, you know, I'm still very active with like helping out with things across some other schools. But yeah, now I'm just back to my orchestra director position at Key Academy, which is one of their middle schools. And I've been doing this for about 8 years. So string orchestra and I don't know if you know about the mission of KIPP DC or what the organization is about, but it's basically free tuition-free public charter school education for students in low-income communities.
Okay.
Underserved or under-resourced. I forget the political terminology around it. But it's basically students who are often forgotten about in the whole public education landscape, in terms of funding, in terms of resources, in terms of access, in terms of opportunity. So, I've been here for 8 years. In addition, I still, you know, teach privately at home. I still perform. So I just actually came back from Detroit. Had some planning to do out there, and attended this wonderful conference with the Sphinx Organization, which caters to African American and Latino musicians in classical music.
Oh, cool.
So I think they had about over 600 people at the conference. It was called the Epicenter for Artists and Leaders in Diversity. And so I'm just trying to continue sharpening my sword and, you know, getting out there networking and conferencing so I can bring back a lot of things to my kids here. And today, actually, we have the Youth Orchestra of the Americas Global Leaders Program coming to work with the kids for 2 weeks. So they send in string players from all over the world, Belize, Colombia, Canada, all over, to just sort of give students that global perspective that they need if they want to become musicians on a global scale. So I'm really excited. It's my favorite time of the year when they come, because it's about five of them. And so kids get private lessons and one-to-one instruction, small group lessons. So I'm only one person, and normally my load is about 320 kids. So
yeah.
It's nice to, yeah, it's a lot. So it's nice to have other people come and just, you know, offer students their perspective of what it's like to be out here in the field doing what we do.
Yeah. What ages are you working with?
So I'm in middle school.
Okay.
normally I'm fifth through eighth grade, but I am this year currently only seventh and eighth grade. And then I do an all eighth grade honors orchestra. So next year we'll slowly start adding the other grades back in. So yeah, we'll see what happens with that.
You are a busy, busy woman.
Oh yes. I like busy though.
Good. When you're out performing in the world and moving through these spaces that are predominantly male in some cases, how do you handle that? Is that ever a challenge?
I think the bigger challenge, more so than gender, is probably race.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I'm navigating not only as a woman, but I'm also navigating as an African-American woman in an industry that's predominantly white male.
Right.
And not even just white American male, right? This is European, you know, white male, because, you know, classical music is coming from the European tradition. And for me, I think my best tool that I use to navigate that road is just being the best me that I can be, just sort of standing firm like a really strong tree planted in the ground in terms of knowing the history of the things that, you know, the history of the music that I might be performing or the composer who I might be studying, knowing as much as I possibly can about where I am in terms of the space that I'm occupying in music, whether that be, you know, collaborating with a chamber music group, whether that be sitting in an orchestra, but just knowing and acknowledging and understanding the space that I'm in as a performer, and just sort of making sure, going back to the notion of just being the best me that I can be. You know, I only know how to be me. I can only be me. And so if I'm always trying to be someone different, depending on what space I'm occupying or what environment I'm in, I never really have a clear sense of who Dawn is as a person. And I feel like when you really don't have a clear sense of who you are as a person, it's sort of very easy to be influenced by, you know, any sort of attractive opinion or notion or philosophy that might come your way. And so, you know, I take all of those things. I definitely take them into consideration, but they're not sort of my end-all source of knowing, or, you know, sort of flip-flopping based on, oh, well, I'm here around an orchestra full of white men today, so I have to conduct myself. No, like, I'm just me. I'm going to strive to be the best me that I can be, the best person that I can be, to know as much as I can, to practice as much as I can, to just sort of be the best that I can be in the things that I've been blessed with, and just take that with me wherever I go, but still being open, you know, to new interpretations of things, to different groups of people, to different ethnicities, to learning as much as I can about other people, and using that, you know, newly acquired knowledge to, you know, not inform who I am, but sort of add it, you know, almost like a little seasoning to, you know, help make me better because I have a more informed perspective of who I am.
Yeah. Is your husband in the arts as well?
No, my husband's actually a former athlete.
Okay.
So yeah, he was a college football player, went really, really far, almost entered the draft, and then he was injured. But actually now, my husband works right down the street from me. He also teaches at a public charter school in the under-resourced, underserved community.
Okay.
And he's a high school English teacher. So he's about maybe 5 minutes down the street from me. But, you know, he has this incredible passion for football. And over the years, throughout the course of our relationship, you know, we've, you know, discovered all of these parallels between artists and athletes. And so, you know, that's been a great source of joy for us. And just in terms of the development of our relationship, because while it looks on the surface like we may have nothing in common, I'm coming from the arts, he's coming from athletics, it's actually so much, so, so much that we have in common. And he still has this undying passion and love for football. So he actually coaches football at the school where he teaches. So he's their English teacher, and he's also one of their football coaches. So if you don't do your homework, you're not going to football practice.
That's wonderful. Yeah, well, I mean, it takes the same kind of hard work.
Oh, yeah.
To do either one. They're both so difficult. Mm-hmm. So that's great. But
yeah.
Even it's though really great. You don't have it in common, he can still appreciate what you do and understand
Absolutely.
What you do.
Absolutely. And he's just, I mean, he's been such a rock for me in terms of, you know, we have this crazy lifestyle as artists, you know, you're home 1 week, then you have to pick up and go somewhere for another week, then you're back home, then you have to go practice 5 hours a day, and then you have this rehearsal, and then you have this gig, and then so you're just kind of like running all over the place. But he's been really just sort of steadfast in support, I mean, just relentless support, because it's not easy for, especially, you know, to be in a relationship with someone who might not particularly be an artist or has even really had that much exposure to the performing arts, particularly classical performing arts. And so, you know, just trying with every opportunity that comes my way to use these sorts of things is just, you know, to open up who we are as a family and to learn more and to grow more and to attend performances and just sort of, you know, sharing that experience together with, you know, I'm constantly learning as an artist. And so it's really nice to have my husband growing and learning with me and just helping me to see, you know, different perspectives to things because, you know, helping me with decision making. Hey, you know, I'm kind of on the fence about this opportunity, you know, make the list of pros, make the list of cons, and just having that voice of reason to be like, well, this completely makes no sense. Oh, I think you should go with this because this one. So it's really nice to have that person outside of myself to help me through that process.
That's wonderful. Yeah. Have you found with, since you've been teaching for so many years now, are they pretty flexible with you? Like if you do get an opportunity that you're really excited about that you want to go away for a week, that kind of thing, has it been tricky to balance those things out or do they let you have some freedom?
I think it's a little bit of both. I think the key word you mentioned there was balance. So of course, you know, I am a full-time teacher, so that's, you know, where the heart of my responsibility lies. But for example, I just came back from, I missed 3 days last week because I was out in Detroit at this huge conference in a field that I'm most passionate about. So that was like a no-brainer, like just, hey, you know, I understand. I try to give them as much leeway as possible in terms of I've known since September. So I'm letting you know in September that in February that I'm going to be gone for a couple of days. And then they're also, you know, when you're a classroom teacher, there are also opportunities for professional development. So this particular conference that I just came back from, I sort of, you know, put it in, but put that time in as a professional development opportunity. And then I'm so happy I did it because it was the biggest professional development opportunity that I've had the opportunity to take advantage of since I've been teaching. You know, I also have performances at the Kennedy Center every now and again where, you know, a 10 o'clock rehearsal on a Tuesday morning conflicts with my 10 o'clock class and I'm supposed to be teaching here. And so, you know, when opportunities like that come along, I really just sort of weigh the options. And I try to actually bring a lot of my students to some of those opportunities too. So, you know, if I'm playing with Soulful Symphony, which is an orchestra that's based in Baltimore, I love to get my students to the open rehearsals. And it's sort of like, hey guys, we're moving class to the Meyerhoff Symphony Hall today. You guys are going to be taking notes. You're actually going to see me on stage performing. and just sort of trying to, you know, have those two worlds come together as much as possible. Because it's really important for my students to see, you know, I'm not just in here telling you how to do these things, but I'm also practicing what I preach. And I want you to have the opportunity to see these things in action, especially in a field where ticket prices for, you know, some things that I do are upwards of $150, $200. Like it's crazy. And so, but if there's, you know, a friend performing, hey guys, do you mind if I have one or two tickets for two students who won a competition this week? Or, you know, hey guys, do you mind if I bring about 10 kids along to this open rehearsal today? Or if it's an evening concert, even better. Hey everybody, here's a flyer. There's a concert tonight, you know, at Union Market. Come down with your family and friends. There's a free concert at the Kennedy Center. So just trying to bring those two worlds together as much as possible. But I think, you know, going back to that keyword that you mentioned with balance, you know, it's not always that clear cut and easy. And so, you know, for example, this week I was supposed to maybe go down to Jacksonville to do some chamber music playing down there, but it fell right in the heart of when the residents were coming from all over the world. So obviously that's an opportunity where, you know, hey, sorry, I can't make it this time because this is going on at the same time. So just, you know, it's a balancing act, weighing things out. It's a scheduling madness that happens too. But organization is the key to all of that. Organization and prioritizing everything. I think once you really have a clear system of how to organize yourself and prioritize your life in a way where you do things that are most meaningful to you and sometimes have to balance them out with things that aren't as, you know, meaningful to you. I think, you know, once you figure out that balance, you're in a good position.
Yeah. Was teaching something that you were interested in pursuing right from getting out of school, or did that kind of occur to you later?
Yeah, I've been teaching probably since like my freshman year of high school, whether it be, you know, other kids who are also freshmen or middle schoolers. Uh-huh. I used to teach right in my mom's living room growing up in Miami, you know, students who were preparing for youth orchestra auditions, and I was still in high school. And so I come from a family of educators. Okay. My mom's a college professor. My dad was a teacher. All of my aunts are teachers. My grandfather was a school principal. So
gotcha.
It's in the DNA. It's in the DNA.
Awesome.
Even if I wanted to run from it, I couldn't, because it's so much a part of who I am.
Yeah.
My husband always tells me, you couldn't stop teaching if you wanted to. Like, it's just a part of like who you are. And I love it because it also helps to develop you as a performer, and it also helps to develop you as an artist. And one of the most important things with teaching is it teaches you how to really effectively communicate.
Yeah.
Especially when you're trying to teach a child, a very young child who might not have that same language developed as you have as an adult, right? So just being able to strategize different ways to communicate with different learning styles, with different skill levels, and sort of, you know, with that breaking down of that process, you actually teach yourself a thing or two about, hey, this is like, you've made everything so incredibly complicated, you know?
Yeah.
When you speak to a child, you have to simplify things a lot. And it's like, well, why am I making my life so complicated when it's actually something as simple as this? And so just having that sort of self-reflection in the process of teaching, you know, I feel like that can sometimes be a bit of the balance with, you know, teaching 5, 6, 7 hours a day, but also still nurturing your development with who you are as an artist and who you are as a person and a creative being.
Yeah. Well, something that I normally ask is, how does your family react to your choice to pursue the arts as a career?
Mm-hmm.
But since you're teaching, I'm assuming that they're fully on board.
Yes. It's so funny. My mom always reminds me, I should say, you know, don't forget that in addition to being a teacher, you've also invested a very large part of your life in performing.
Mm-hmm.
And to not completely just let that drop by the wayside or completely neglect that. And I'll be completely honest with you, after we graduated, I did undergrad and grad school at
right.
Juilliard. So that was there for 6 years, four mm-hmm. years for undergrad, 2 years for my master's. And I was just mentally, emotionally, physically exhausted. Literally, like, graduation came around and I just needed to take a step back.
Yeah.
So, you know, I would play gigs here and there, practice here and there, you know, all that kind of stuff. But I wasn't putting in the 4 or 5 hours a day that I was when I was a student. And so I feel like, and that was actually for a couple of years.
Mm.
So I would say it wasn't until, I mean, going back to Briley and just this whole new outlook on life after giving life,
uh-huh.
You know, I would probably say within the past 3 or 4 years was the time when I really started, you know, picking myself back up again and putting my life back together, because I lost sight of, you know, what was my end goal with performing? What was
right.
my end goal with practicing? When you're in school, you know, you're learning this concerto and you're playing this orchestra piece and you're going on this tour and you're doing all of these sorts of things, but who are you really as an artist, and what do you want to do with all of these things that you're learning? Where do you want them to take you? Where do you want to go with them? And I lost sight of that when I finished school. And so I'm happy, you know, everything happens for a reason. I'm happy I actually took those couple of years to just sort of get back to knowing me.
Yeah.
And who I am, you know, the type of artist I want to be, the type of wife, the type of mother, the type of teacher, all of those sorts of things. And so I needed that time to just sort of, I didn't realize it in the midst of it all. I did not realize that that's where I was mentally and physically and spiritually and emotionally. But looking back on it now that I'm in such a much better place than I was in the couple of years after I graduated, I'm so thankful I went to that process, because it really, are you there, Leah?
Oh, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Oh, okay. Sorry.
Yeah, I'm here.
I was just saying, I'm really thankful I went through that process, because now I appreciate everything that I have so much more than I would have had I not, I mean, almost for lack of a better term, like, just lost it all, that kind of feeling.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm just thankful that I've been able to piece the puzzle back together with the things that, you know, Dawn Michelle Johnson wants to do with her life, and, you know, the people who I want to touch and the people who I want to reach. And just, you know, how I want to raise my child.
Since you've had your daughter, and I mean, you're teaching all these kids, you're so busy.
Mm-hmm.
How are you figuring that out as a mom? Like, how are you finding time to, like, also just be an individual. I'm learning from you. We don't have kids yet, but I'm learning from you.
It's another balancing act. It really is another balancing act. But in the sense of a child, you know, my husband and I, we are her sole caretakers. We are responsible 100% for her life. And so obviously that's priority number one. Mm-hmm. And, you know, with everything else, it's just trying to shuffle things around with the remaining balance, right? So my number one and my number two are wife, mother, period. And, you know, 90% of the time, there's no conflict between, you know, professional obligations and home personal obligations. But we've just sort of structured our lives in such a way where we've made room and made time to know and understand that, like, she needs us first. Homework gets done every night, you know, as soon as you walk in the door, right? Like, we're not, my husband actually cooks every single day. Very seldomly do we eat out. And so, you know, when we get home, he's cooking, I'm practicing, she's doing her homework. So everybody's sort of working together and doing their part to make this sort of well-rolled machine, you know, work. You know, she recently changed schools because we moved a little further out of the city. And so, you know, my husband's out the door at 6 something in the morning. But before he leaves, you know, he's brushing teeth, washing face, getting breakfast ready, packing lunch, all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then once he's out the door, all I have to do is just put clothes on and, you know, let's go. And then I get you to school and then I get to work. Mm-hmm. So just, you know, finding, again, that balance of what works for you and what works for your family. Obviously, especially, you know, when they're newborns and really young, they get sick all the time. So it's like, oh my gosh, wait, well, how can I take a week off here and then another week off here? Oh, wait, you can't take off here. You have a football game. And just sort of, you know, again, that balancing act. But, you know, we've been really blessed to have, I call them angels, positioned in very strategic places in our lives. And I have a wonderful, wonderful boss here at KIPP DC who just has never, he's always understood. And, you know, I made it very clear to him, you know, I'm giving you 150% in what I'm capable of doing as a teacher and, you know, really helping to educate our students here. But, you know, like he always says, he says, life happens, right? And life happens to everybody. So it's really nice to have someone who understands that and who's just always right there. You know, there was a day where it was a terrible rainstorm and I couldn't get in touch with my husband and my daughter was still at daycare. And I was like, hey, like, can't get in touch with Brian. Briley's still at school. He literally dropped everything that he did in that moment. It was like, we gotta go, and like threw me in his car and was like, we gotta go get her. So just being, you know, having a really, really wonderful support system. We have great my in-laws are here.
Great.
Yeah, they actually just moved maybe like 5 minutes away from us.
Oh, wow.
So that's been really, really helpful because they don't have, you know, the typical 9-to-5 work schedule. So now if Briley gets sick, for example, you know, it's off to grandma's house we go.
That's huge.
And we can still go to work and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So just, you know, being very prayerful about, you know, when these things do come up or, you know, if there's a day that's a bit tricky, like you always get through, like, you know. Yeah. One of my favorite things to live by is like, God doesn't give us anything that we can't handle. And so just always knowing that like, everything's going to be fine. Everything is fixable. Everything is going to work out. It just sort of helps to alleviate that stress that comes along with, oh my God, what am I going to do? There's very little of that now because we can do because God said we can.
Yeah.
And it just, literally, it works every single time.
Yeah. I was going to ask why DC, but is that where your husband's from?
No, he's actually from Pittsburgh.
Okay.
We met actually when I was at Juilliard, probably, I think I just started grad school, and we met spring break in Jamaica. A close friend of ours had put together a trip of 8 of her closest friends. It's very real world, but like none of us knew each other. We all just had descriptions of who to look for in the airports in our connecting cities. And so we got there. She had rented this beautiful like villa. Spring break, it was real world spring break. But he had actually, we had a driver who was picking us up from the airport. So I connected with the other young lady who I was meeting up with in the airport. And we were just stranded in the airport for hours. We were like, oh my God, there's no driver. We're broke college students. We're being punked. It was like at the height of Ashton Kutcher's punk. We're in another country. What are we going to do? And so we like put some money together and we paid like $50, which is a lot of money for a broke college kid. And we like took a taxi. We had the address of the house that we were going to. And so we got to the house, and then maybe a couple hours later, he shows up with the driver. And we're like, wait a second. You were supposed to meet us at the airport and take us all here. And so his flight ended up getting in a little bit earlier. And so he like took the driver to go have a beer somewhere and just completely left us stranded at the airport. And the rest is history. Here we are, nearly 10 years later, married with a kid.
You forgave him. Right. But are you enjoying DC? You guys think you're there for the long haul?
Possibly.
Yeah.
We're kind of up in the air right now with, you know, next moves. But I mean, our number one informant right now is just school, obviously, for Briley. So we have a lot of options to sort of weigh out there. And I guess when both of your parents are teachers, they're a little harsher on the requirements of, you know, what your education is going to look like. And so, you know, we'll see. We're open to staying in DC, but we're also open to, you know, going other places and seeing. We're sort of nomads. We like to travel around. We like to see different people and, you know, have new experiences.
Yeah.
And so, you know, once we start to get into a pattern of just like the monotony of just every day, hi, same people, hey, same places, you know, we start to get a little restless. So maybe we need like a nice long vacation and we'll come back and we'll stay in DC forever. Or maybe we'll say, oh, you know,
we've
run our course in DC, you know, let's go somewhere else and see what it's like to live there. My heart though is still very much in Florida and Miami and beach and sun and colorful, you know, clothing and, you know, really sort of out there personalities.
Yeah.
And DC is a little bit more reserved in that regard. So we'll see.
Can I ask, has the mood changed a lot in DC since the inauguration? Or is it just business as usual?
Yeah, I don't know if it's changed necessarily as things have become more in focus. So I feel like some of the things that we're experiencing here in D.C. Have sort of always been there or have already been brewing prior to number 45.
Mm-hmm.
But I think definitely the culture within what we experience in our classrooms on a day-to-day basis has not changed, but it's allowed students to become more vocal about their feelings in the process of everything that's been happening. I feel like, you know, before everything was kind of like, okay, let's get down to this curriculum and let's learn these math problems and let's learn how to play this piece of music. And so now you really are forced, or if you don't feel like you're forced, you're doing yourself and your students a disservice as an educator. But you're really, you know, put in a position where you are responsible for taking on the concerns and the questions that students have about everything that's happening. You know, I made it a point, well, I've been making it a point particularly throughout Black History Month, where I think like 99.99% of our student population are African Americans.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we open up every class with a video called From the Top. And it's like, you know, performers, minority performers, either in the field of classical music or just music in general, particularly playing string instruments, you know, just showing what they do on a day-to-day basis. There's a guy who goes to Juilliard. He calls himself that viola kid. And so he has, you know, a bunch of YouTube videos that talks about what it's like for him as a young African-American man in the day as a Juilliard student. And so the kids have really enjoyed watching his series. You know, they just watched recently the winners of the Sphinx competition, which are, you know, the best of the best in young African-American Latino string performers. They love the group Black Violin.
Mm-hmm.
They're just so interested in seeing more and more people who look like them doing things out of the norm of what you would, you know, necessarily be seeing young African-American students and young Hispanic students doing, or that media image portrayal of what Black and Spanish people are doing on a day-to-day basis. And you literally see almost like their heart jump out of their mouth because they're like, oh my gosh, like, there's a whole nother world out there than just the world that's made available to me right here in my community. And so that's one of my really you know, special moments in teaching is, you know, taking all of those questions and curiosities and concerns and incorporating them into our lessons from day to day. It forces me to grow as an educator. It also forces me to grow as a, you know, as an artist and as a performer, because I'm listening to young people tell me the things that they want to see and the things that they want to hear. And it's going to be, you know, the way that I present it to them that's going to have the long-lasting effects on how they perceive these things moving forward in their lives. So it's a delicate balance. You have to be very careful with not letting your immediate personal reaction to things be at the forefront of those discussions, because I try to stay very objective so they can form their own opinions. I don't want my opinion. I always put on the top of every assignment, I'm not grading you on your opinion, just so they feel very comfortable and it's a safe space for them to express who they are. Particularly in public education right now, you know, music, at least at this particular school, it's the only creative outlet sort of class that they have. Everything else is very sort of academic outside of PE and, you know, Spanish. But in terms of the creative arts, this is the class for them to be in that creative space. And so I try to push beyond the borders of just, oh, let's pick up our violins and our violas and play our D major scale and then let's go play Twinkle Twinkle Little Star. Right. But just sort of, you know, incorporating those. Oh, well, you know, well, when I look at orchestras, all I see are a bunch of white people on the stage. I don't see any black people on the stage. Well, let me show you this orchestra. Here's an orchestra that is 100% African-American and Spanish musicians. Does that change your perspective just a little bit? And so just asking these really open-ended questions to force them to do the thinking as opposed to me to do the thinking for them. And just, you know, allowing safe space. The first 15 minutes of every class is just an open discussion based off your reaction to the video, which often, you know, segues into many other, you know, conversations about race and politics and all of those sorts of things. So last week, we watched this really, really wonderful video. When I was in Detroit at the Sphinx Conference, they premiered a piece titled The Seven Last Words of the Unarmed. And so it was a new composition based on the last words of seven African-American men who were killed at the hands of law enforcement within the past couple of years. So it opened up, one movement had Trayvon Martin's last words, and it was the University of Michigan men's choir with the Sphinx Orchestra, and I mean, it was just an incredible experience. And Trayvon's last words were, "Why are you following me?" And so they created a whole movement and a piece just based off of those words, "Why are you following me?" There was Eric Garner, "I Can't Breathe." Trying to think, Amadou Diallo, his last words to his mother were, "Mom, I got into college." And so with the KIPP DC network of schools, one of their mottos is, "We get kids to and through college." So for them to hear the piece open up with a young African-American male whose final words before he passed away were, "Mom, I got into college," you know, it opened up a conversation about, well, we, you know, he was innocent. He did everything right. He got into college. How is he not here to be in college right now and to continue telling that story? And so it's really interesting to hear their reactions to things like that. And it forces them to really think outside of the box as in terms of, you know, the opportunities that may or may not be available to you. But where are you going to find yourself in this overall landscape of injustice that is sweeping, you know, that has always been, right? We just have more access to it now. Yeah. But that has been sweeping our country. And you, as the young people, you are going to inform, you know, how these things move forward. And so, you know, I'm always really interested to see and hear their reactions. But more importantly, you know, I'm still an orchestral music teacher at the end of the day, how it influences the way in which they play their instruments.
But so, then it's all connected and they don't have to walk in your classroom and shut themselves off.
Absolutely. I say, as long as it's school appropriate, you know, we're not going to be dropping F-bombs and all that kind of, although sometimes there's some words that get thrown around. But when the words get thrown around, it's just a genuine, honest reaction. Yeah. And I'm teaching, you know, young teenagers. I'm not teaching 5-year-olds or 6-year-olds. I'm teaching literally young teenagers who, you know, just want to express themselves as explicitly and as passionately as possible. And I think it's really important not to discourage that. But, you know, just if you want people to listen to you, well, if you're cursing every other word, you know, people are going to be less inclined to listen to you. So let's develop the language that you need to discuss these issues. And then, so, you know, when you have these discussions outside of the classroom, you want people to listen to you. So let's, you know, help you, you know, put together, you know, still in your language, dream in your language, speak in your language, but how can we open up that that language to have more of an impact on people who might not speak the same language as you?
Right.
So. Mm-hmm.
Mm. Mm. Do you know Samora Pinderhughes? He was in the jazz program, probably maybe after you left.
I think that was probably after I left.
All right, I'm going to email you about or if you want to go back, he was on the podcast, but he's put out this piece that your students might be really interested in called The Transformation Suite, that's all about activism, and it's really amazing, but I'll email it to you. But
you said The Transformation Suite?
Yeah.
Okay.
And it's got one of the actors from school does this poetry over it, and it's really amazing what he's made, but...
Love it.
Totally connected to all of that.
Love it.
Is there anything from the past year or two that you're really proud of that you want to tell me about? Like a lesson you've learned or
That's a great question.
That? It doesn't have to be like a huge thing.
Mm-hmm. Anything in the past year or two that I am very proud of? This is a really good question, actually, because I get so caught up in the hustle and bustle of life that, very seldom do I stop and, sort of reflect. Yeah. On everything. Let's see. Well, I know I keep talking about this Sphinx conference.
Well, it sounds like you just had an amazing time there.
I mean, Leah, it was the best. It was the best thing, not even thing. It was the best event for literally artists, leaders, advocates for diversity. This particular organization primarily works with the field of classical music and sort of expanding the numbers of African Americans and Latino musicians that you see in the American symphonic landscape. But I mean, just attending that conference was, my soul needed that. I didn't realize how much my soul needed it. It was, 5 days of probably almost every African American principal player in, American orchestras.
Wow.
It was sessions that involved interviews, with people like Melissa Harris Perry, interviewing the founder of the Sphinx organization, who was Aaron Dworkin, watching, in one of my idols, Martina Arroyo, be interviewed for an award at the Sphinx Conference. She was one of the first African-American women to, grace the stages of the Metropolitan Opera. So just seeing people who look like me and who are as passionate as I am about bringing diversity to a field that is just so primarily white.
Yeah.
And it was a gathering of over 500 people who were just as passionate, who care just as much, but who are also the top performers in the field who are experiencing some of the same difficulties, in different geographical locations around the country. Why can't Black and Latino musicians either win orchestra jobs or just have the same prominence in their performing careers as everyone else? Why are these sort of opportunities denied? And so what the conference did was it took all of these really fundamental questions about diversity in the arts, and it forced you to sit down and, number one, take a closer look at the issues, what could be some of the causes, but everything was just so very solution-oriented. I feel like we talk about these things a lot and sort of just get lost in this wash of, endless possibilities, but actually making it concrete and actually making it tangible and actionable and looking for the results. I think this conference did a great job in addressing that, but also bridging across, the genre. The final concert had Karen Clark Sheard, who's a really 4-time winning Grammy gospel artist, collaborate with the Sphinx Symphony, singing John Legend and Common's Glory. And so just that sense of, pride, this sense of, people coming together because they believe very deeply in the core of their souls that there is a place for minorities in this field, and we are all actively doing our part in bringing more opportunities for particularly young African Americans and young Latino musicians to show them that this is something that's possible for you, and you don't have to fall into these stereotypes. You don't have to be someone's stat. And so, your life is, the possibilities for your life are endless, they're limitless. And so, just to not be so consumed in trying to abide by this, this box of limits that society has placed around you, but just sort of breaking free through all of that and just living the life that God has destined you to live and created you. You know, if we were all meant to do the same things, then there'd be one person walking around the earth, and, you know, that would be it. But we all have such unique and special gifts that we've all been blessed with, and to see everyone using those gifts for a greater good other than themselves, but for the field, right? Not me as a performer, what are my opportunities as a performer, but for everyone collectively in the field. You had people just starting out, people who have won 4 Grammys, you know, people who have been awarded $1 million grants from the Mellon Foundation. You have all of these working parts, you know, coming together to make sure that our young people coming up behind us have more opportunities than we've had, and just creating that safe space for them to just want to continue dreaming and living in a world bigger than what they might see immediately in front of them.
Yeah. And to have that community, so addressing those problems so you're not just feeling like, oh, I'm over here in DC having this experience and how do I take action, but to have everybody together being like, you're not the only one who's faced that. What can we do as a community? That's really really amazing. Mm-hmm. And this was the first time you'd had contact with that organization.
So I've actually been in the Sphinx. We call ourselves the Sphinx family. Since I was a teenager, probably since like late high school, early Juilliard days.
Awesome.
And I went and played in the orchestra for maybe a year or two back when I was in school. But like I said, you know, when I finished school, I took a major step back from everything. And so in September, I was presented with the fellowship to attend the conference as a Sphinx Fellow. So in order to be a fellow, you have to either have been an alumni of the symphony or at a competition or be affiliated with the organization in some way, shape, or form. And so I was awarded this fellowship, and I immediately said, absolutely, because they're such a reputable organization, and they do so many wonderful things in the field of classical music that I just knew it was something that I absolutely had to be a part of. And I actually just thought to myself, it was the first time I actually traveled without my family since I had Briley.
Oh,
and so I was actually really apprehensive and nervous about that. But I said, you know, this is the only thing that will make me, you know, leave home for 5 days.
Yeah.
Because I knew I would come back just better than when I left. So it was great.
That sounds amazing. Well, I have kept you for a long time. I just have we could keep talking forever, obviously,
yes,
but I have two short questions just to wrap it up. So one is, when you're having a day where you're feeling uninspired or just unmotivated or something like that, are there concrete things that you reach for again and again? I know you said prayer, but is there like a book that you reach for, or a certain piece of music that you listen to, or a place that you go that helps you get out of that feeling?
Yeah, it's actually a combination of things. I mean, like you already said, definitely prayer.
Mm-hmm.
But there's another book associated with prayer called the Bible. So, I mean, and it sounds, as cliche as it may sound, it's really been my saving grace as a person, as an artist, as an educator, as just all the way around. And so I really try to attach my feelings onto scriptures. You know, there's scriptures that, you know, address a feeling of despair. There are scriptures that, you know, address worry. In particular for me, like, I'm a worrier. And so turning that worrying into, you know, this sense of, hey, my worrying is actually me having a lack of faith. Let me go find myself some scriptures to read in the Bible that address this issue of having a lack of faith. So, you know, just sitting, spending some time with that. Nothing too, you know, strenuous, maybe 2 or 3 verses to marinate a day. There's also a book that actually one of my coworkers, who's also a friend of mine, gave me. And it's a book on, it's called Fervent. And it's a book on strategic, deliberate prayer, particularly for women. And so just addressing this issue of, you know, when things aren't happening the way we want them to in our lives, or, you know, there's so much just going about day to day that we can, you know, become overwhelmed. It's a book where, you know, you actually, like, on post-its inside of the book, write down your deliberate, strategic, specific prayer for that day. And there are also scriptures, you know, sort of webbed throughout the whole book. And you can always refer back to it. You know, it says that by the time you finish this book, it should look like you know, it's been ran over by a truck like 30 times because you constantly refer to it so many times, and you've ripped it up and you've written in it and you've put things on your bathroom window. And so just being really concrete with things like that. My husband's an English teacher, like I said, and his passion is African-American literature. I mean, mm-hmm. if you looked at his nightstand, just a stack of books every night. And so I find that particularly when I'm down on myself for issues related to race, which has been more so nowadays than, you yeah. know, ever. I want to be really informed and know my history as an African-American woman and, you know, try to be as objective as I can when discussing these issues, not with just my child, but other people in the community, and particularly other people's children. Right. I want to make sure that the things that I'm saying are factual, and I want to make sure that the things that I'm saying have a deeply rooted spirit in the African-American community. So a lot of African-American literature, essays, you know, James Baldwin, Dick Gregory, you know, just some of the really great poets and authors from the Harlem Renaissance, looking back through that, you know, lens of history and, you know, the experiences that my predecessors have experienced throughout, you know, since, you know, 1600s when slaves were first brought to this country, you know, those experiences have been documented. And so just being able to connect and hold on to my ancestry that includes people, particularly women, who have gone through way worse experiences and who've documented them, but not just documented their personal experiences, but, you know, documented their involvement and how they helped other members of their community overcome sort of these hardships. I want to, you know, take those experiences and sort of, you know, put them into my toolbox of how I can, as a 20, you know, as an African-American woman living in the 21st century in Washington, D.C., right?
Yeah.
You know, I can find strength through the experiences of my ancestors who went through far worse. And, you know, just knowing that, you know, there's still work to do, obviously, but, you know, that empowering strength that comes along with, hey, these people made it out of the horrors of the slave trade, the atrocities of just things that, you know, happened in the early days of slavery through Jim Crow. You know, I haven't been sprayed down with a water hose. I haven't been shot, you know, God, you know, God forbid. You know, I haven't been, you know, God forbid, I haven't been raped. I haven't had any of these horrible things that were just commonplace, right, within the African-American community from the early days of slavery. Those things, I have not experienced personally, those things. So there's always this optimistic feeling. You know, there's always somebody going through something far worse than what you're going through. And so I find optimism in connecting myself through literature of, you know, my ancestors, through the Bible, through fervent. And also, you know, my mother gave me a book called Mozart for a Mother's Soul. and so, you know, just sort of more lighthearted pieces like that. We read to Briley every single night. We don't take a day off from reading. So I find joy in Jack and the Beanstalk. And it's just, you know, so refreshing at the end of the day where you've done all of this heavy lifting to just come and read a nursery rhyme, come and read a fairy tale. You know, let's read your book about trolls. You know, so, and I say, you know, that's how children are such a blessing to our lives, too. They just sort of allow things to lighten up. A little bit and just sort of have this really refreshing view. And you don't want to, you know, taint this refreshing perspective that they have because they've only been alive for a couple of hundred days, right? And so just, you know, finding ways to balance sort of the heavy duty lifting and the heavy duty literature with the more spiritual place in scripture, with the lightheartedness of, you know, fun, playful children's literature.
Yeah, those are all good things. Yeah. Then the last question is, have you seen anything recently that you want to recommend, either a live event in DC or a movie or anything you like?
That's really, really great. Well, instead of watching the inauguration, Brian and I watched Birth of a Nation, which was phenomenal. It was very, very, very well done.
I haven't seen it.
Oh, Leah, it's great. I actually walked away with it with a feeling of like, no wonder they had to go digging deeply into his past to bring these sort of negative issues about him personally to light. Who is it? Nate Parker?
Yeah, the director, right?
Right. And he got caught up in all like the rape and all that kind of stuff. But I mean, I believe firmly that it's a story that America overall doesn't want you to see or doesn't want you to know. And so I walked away with the feeling of like, man, they had to pull out everything that they could to shut this down, because this is a story that particularly African Americans need to see. You know, you read about Nat Turner, but actually seeing these things, and you know, there's some degree of Hollywood license and all of that kind of stuff, but I don't think, you know, they did too much in terms of editing down Nat Turner's narrative. And so that was something that was very eye-opening for me, and very important to see. And when we watch movies like that, we always have to watch when Briley's like at school or, you know, I was like, oh, let's watch Frozen. Okay, let's go out. Nat Turner, Birth of a Nation. So that was something that was really, really, really great. I'm performing actually next month at a very unique event. I don't even know what it's going to be about yet, but the title is very exciting. It's called The Rite of Spring Dance Party, based off of Stravinsky's famous piece, Rite of Spring.
Okay.
It's like this sort of like outdoor market space. So I'm excited. The name is catchy. And I think it's like a small orchestra, and I don't know if people will be dancing. I don't know what people will be doing, but it's at Dock 5 Union Market in D.C. on, I believe it's March 13th at 8:30 p.m. I can, like, send you more of the details on
it. Yeah, and I'll let people know.
Yeah, and then my husband and I went to Mos Def's final, or I guess he's known as Yasin Bey now, his final concerts in America, at the Kennedy Center over New Year's Eve, actually into New Year's Day. And that was just an incredible experience because I went on tour with him for a little while when I was in Juilliard. And he and my husband hit it off really well, like years and years ago. And so Mos Def is, and you know, when we first started dating, Mos Def was like probably the only, between Mos Def and Lauryn Hill, it was like all we listened to. And so to, you know, go to his final concert, he gave us a little private concert one night during a rehearsal many, many years ago, and to go back, you know, for his final show in the U.S., I learned so much through music, about music through him and through my experiences with working with him, and to just see, you know, an artist of such high caliber but still be so incredibly down to earth. And just loves being around people and loves the art of music, and it's just so, you know, spiritually grounded. I really enjoyed that experience at his concert that night.
Yeah, that must have been amazing.
Oh, it was
on
amazing.
New Year's Eve, geez.
It was amazing. And then he brought out like Robert Glasper and his group, and it was just great. The room was, but you know what's so interesting about concerts like that? When you're in like places like the Kennedy Center or Carnegie Hall or like these major sort of concert hall spaces, I feel like people are kind of apprehensive to like get up and dance and move and like have a good time.
There's like a formality.
Yeah, like we never shy away from that because we're like, we just paid $200 for a ticket. So we're going to come in here. We're going to have a really, really good time.
Yeah.
And we did. I mean, we had a phenomenal time, you know, often the only people like standing up dancing. But with Brian's perspective from, you know, when he came to a couple of Mos Def shows that I did back in college at like Carnegie Hall, I always knew where he was in the audience because he was the only person standing up dancing and doing all of these sorts of things. So I think we have to find a way, especially with, you know, more and more sort of cross-genre music coming into concert halls, just finding a way to, you know, make audiences feel like it's okay to let your hair down a little bit. You know, it's okay to clap between the movement because, you know, that sort of etiquette. Actually is for an artist performing, you know, you feed off of the energy of the audience. And when everyone's just sitting there, like reading their program notes, being prim and proper and all of those sorts of things, it takes away from what the artist is able to give because they don't have that energy to, you know, sort of feed off of. It just makes it too formal, you know, like this is, just great music. Have fun. There's a nice beat to it. Dance. He's dancing, you know, he's throwing roses all over the stage. Like, let's just have that same amount of fun. So.
Dawn, thank you so much. This was such a pleasure. And hey, it's so exciting to hear about everything you're involved in.
Thank you. This has been amazing for me. Thank you for my first podcast interview. And it's been, I mean, really, really fun. It's great to see you. I haven't seen you in a really long time. And you still look like you haven't aged a day since college.
Well, you likewise. I'm gonna stop recording, but I won't hang up just yet so you can say goodbye. Bye. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Compass Podcast. I'm Leah Walsh. More episodes are coming soon. Please look for us on Facebook and iTunes. I'd like to thank the following people for their generosity. The Compass cover art is by Kim Miller, music by Brendan Spieth, audio assistance from Nick Choksi, and a special thanks to Frankie J. Alvarez. See you next time.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but yeah. Not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.